As Ukraine increase efforts to retake land captured by Russian forces, residents in the capital city of Kyiv awoke to a series of air raid sirens as missiles struck more infrastructure in the region. Plus, while challenging, the U.S. Justice Department says it will continue to investigate alleged war crimes.
Perpetrators in particular and would-be perpetrators ought not to underestimate the determination of prosecutors in the United States and elsewhere.
And later in the program, a look at training operations for those fighting against the Russian invasion. Today is Thursday, July 28th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. In the early morning hours, residents in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv were awakened by a whirring sound echoing throughout the city. The renewed missile attacks come as Ukrainian forces continue to mount their counteroffensives against the Russian invaders. Reporter Anna Chernikova joins us with more.
Today, Ukrainians around the country in almost every region woke up very early because starting from 4 a.m., air raid sirens were on in many different regions. More than 20 missiles were launched by Russian forces on the territory of Ukraine. Four regions that suffered the most, so it's Kyiv, Chernihiv, Kharkiv, Mykolaiv, Dnipro, and the worst missile attack happened at around 11 o'clock in the morning in the city of Kropyvnytsky, which is a central part of the country. At least 25 people are injured. Five people, unfortunately, were killed. Ukrainians continue some actions in the Kherson region. We know that more villages were liberated, and we know that more Russian military storages with equipment and with manpower were destroyed as well. And also we hear that there are some advances of the Ukrainian forces in the east. It all happens, you know, in the area of Donetsk region, but it's difficult to say now, you know, exactly the location.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, Ukraine. Be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint. For continued updates throughout the day. A report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence that's dated June 15th but only recently posted online says that the United States intelligence concludes that, quote, Russia almost certainly is using so-called filtration operations to conduct the detention and forced deportation of Ukrainian civilians to Russia, end quote. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden joins us with more details.
This memo that was drafted in mid-June by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence's National Intelligence Council basically lends credence to some of what we've been hearing from both Russian and Ukrainian officials about approximately, according to the which official you listen to, maybe as many as 2 million or more Ukrainians being relocated from Ukraine to Russia. And what this intelligence assessment concludes is that Russia almost certainly is using what they call filtration operations or filtration camps to figure out who gets moved and who's allowed to stay. And what the document says, what the intelligence says, is that, you know, this process includes sometimes temporary detention. They collect data. They interrogate people. In some cases, the Russian forces are being accused of abusing detainees. And then they get moved on, depending on the level of the threat.
Jeff, you mentioned levels of threat, and I was wondering what the report said about what Russians may be considering in determining, you know, what constitutes a level of threat, what allows them to make the determination whether an individual and perhaps a family is allowed to move on to other areas in Ukraine and who would be forcibly detained or deported back to Russia.
According to the intelligence memo, there are kind of three levels of threats, three types of assessments advancements the Russian forces are making when they move into an area occupied and then decide what to do with the Ukrainian residents. On one level, those who are deemed non-threatening, maybe they'll be issued some documentation, be permitted to remain in the Russian occupied areas. In other cases, they're still forcibly deported to Russia. Potential threats, people who the Russian forces see as perhaps down the line, people who might resist Russian occupation, pose other sorts of problems, are usually forcibly deported to Russia. And then once in Russia, they are facing additional screening and perhaps other measures. And then the highest level of threat, according to the intelligence, are those Russian forces view as anyone who has any sort of affiliation with the Ukrainian military or Ukrainian security services. And those folks, according to U.S. intelligence, are probably being detained either in prisons in eastern Ukraine or prisons in Russia. And what happens to them after that, at this point, just isn't known.
Speaking of not knowing, was there any information in the report or the memo that was drafted that gives an inkling as to how many people may be either detained or deported?
There isn't. The memo says that there is, quote, significant uncertainty about how many Ukrainians have gone through this filtration process, how many have been sent forcibly to Russia, either to live as refugees or incarcerated in some way. Again, reporting and statements from Russian and Ukrainian officials as of earlier this month suggested perhaps 2 million people have been affected by this process. But again, as the intelligence memo indicates, and as other intelligence officials from the West have said, there's still many, many questions about what Russia is doing and how much, to the extent that they're doing it, once they slowly make their way into these territories and begin to take them and hold them.
Jeff Zeldin is VOA's national security correspondent. Jeff, thank you. In a false statement, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov previously said that many Ukrainians want Russian citizenship. Polygraph.info explains.
On July 12th, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia is at war with Ukraine's government, not the Ukrainian people. He said the special military operation is against the regime and very many Ukrainians want to become Russian citizens. That is false. In fact, Russia has caused civilian carnage and dislocation across Ukraine. Few Ukrainians are taking up Moscow's offers of citizenship. Kremlin propaganda falsely portrays Kyiv as a, quote, illegal regime. The truth is that Ukraine's parliament and president were chosen in elections that independent observers, even Russian officials, judged legitimate. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's approval exceeds 90%, and 97% trust the country's military. Meantime, surveys show 9 in 10 Ukrainians have a worsening opinion of Russia. Russian bombs and missiles routinely strike civilian targets. The United Nations estimates 5,000 civilian deaths and 6,500 injuries in just the last 4 months. And nearly 6 million Ukrainians have had to flee their homes for safety.
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website that's produced by the Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation and misinformation that's being distributed and shared globally. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that the U.S. has offered Russia a substantial proposal to free detained American basketball star Brittany Griner, as well as former Marine Paul Whelan. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain takes it from here.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken made a rare appearance in the State Department briefing room Wednesday to announce a new proposal in a high-profile case involving the two Americans detained in Russia.
In the coming days, I expect to speak with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov for the first time since the war began. I plan to raise an issue that's a top priority for us: the release of Americans Paul Whelan and Brittany Griner, who've been wrongfully detained and must be allowed to come home. We put a substantial proposal on the table weeks ago to facilitate their release.
Brittany Griner made a court appearance Wednesday in a Moscow suburb court. The two-time Olympic basketball gold medalist and women's NBA champion had played in Russia and was detained in February. She was charged with drug smuggling for possessing cartridges containing cannabis oil. Griner pled guilty and faces up to 10 years in a Russian prison. After the appearance, her lawyer said Griner did not mean to bring cannabis oil into Russia and traveled there despite U.S. travel warnings so that she would not let her Russian teammates down. She was detained just days before Russia invaded Ukraine.
I am innocent of any charge resulting from this potential kidnapping.
Paul Whelan, a security official at an auto parts company, was arrested in Moscow in December 2018. In 2020, he was sentenced to 16 years in prison for espionage, which he strongly denies. The White House confirmed the proposal to Moscow to free Griner and Whelan, but declined to provide details.
But I will say that the president and his team are willing to take extraordinary steps to bring our people home, as we've demonstrated with Trevor Reed. And that's what we're doing right here. It's actively happening now.
CNN and other news agencies report that the United States has offered to swap Griner and Whelan for Victor Bout, a convicted Russian arms smuggler. A high-profile swap of this nature is risky, but the Biden administration has come under significant pressure to bring Griner and Whelan back home, an expert tells VOA.
And, of course, when you have public figures, including sports and, you know, athletes that are recognizable globally calling for the return of Griner, it's really, it can put a lot of pressures.
In April, the United States exchanged former U.S. Marine Trevor Reed for convicted Russian drug smuggler Konstantin Yaroshenko. Kat said despite the risk of setting a bad precedent that could encourage future detentions by rogue governments, the United States takes very seriously its obligation to protect Americans wrongfully detained abroad. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
On Wednesday's program, we heard part one of the conversation between VOA Justice Department correspondent Masoud Farivar and Eli Rosenbaum, as well as Christian Levesque, about their work on the War Crimes Accountability Team. In part two of the chat, we pick things up as Rosenbaum begins discussing the cases that are currently being investigated.
You know, war crimes investigations generally, as we've learned over many, many years, always present serious challenges, often daunting challenges. The fact that the crimes are still being committed, that Ukraine is at war, as one prosecutor abroad said, the entire country arguably is a crime scene. All of these facts make these cases more difficult to build. However, perpetrators in particular and would-be perpetrators ought not to underestimate the determination of prosecutors in the United States and elsewhere to pursue these cases, nor should they estimate the resources that are available to us, cutting-edge investigative techniques that were certainly unavailable, say, at Nuremberg after World War II. And yet they succeeded at Nuremberg without those investigative techniques, without DNA analysis and geofencing and sophisticated communications intercepts and the like. There wasn't even an internet or a cell phone back then. So imagine how much more we can do with the resources that and the techniques that are available to us today.
In terms of where the investigations stand, are investigators at the point where they have identified certain atrocities that would amount to war crimes or crimes against humanity or genocide?
I would say that there is a continuous assessment that is going on. And for prosecutors and law enforcement, what that means is methodically obtaining information, taking investigatory steps, and then only when you feel that you have completed that part of the process can you truly make an assessment that is a conclusion as to whether you believe atrocities have been committed. So it is a methodical process that we undergo to reach those conclusions.
Did you want to add anything to that, Mr. Rosenbaum?
I would just echo what Ms. Levesque has said, which is that for the Department of Justice, these are determinations made in the context of investigations of specific incidents where we may have jurisdiction. I would contrast that with, for instance, the role of the State Department, where they have made and announced determinations about the kinds of crimes that are being perpetrated in Ukraine by Russian forces.
Now, broadly speaking, can either of you talk about some of the more egregious cases of possible war crimes or categories of war crimes that you have come across and found particularly disturbing?
So I could start off with that. You know, as I mentioned before, in reference to our U.S. war crime statute, it covers grave breaches of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, among other violations. But as a result, the focus in terms of war crimes investigation is on grave international crimes. And so some examples of grave international crimes include intentional killings of civilians, torture or inhuman treatment, willfully causing great suffering or serious bodily injury, unlawful deportation or transfer, and unlawful confinement of a protected person. Now, also using rape or sexual assault as a weapon of armed conflict is a serious violation as well. But it is this is the nature of the very serious and grave allegations that we as prosecutors at the Department of Justice, but also our foreign counterparts, are focusing our efforts on.
I was with Attorney General Garland in Ukraine last month when he spoke so movingly about what is happening there. And he said, quote, "America and the world have seen the many horrific images and read the heart-wrenching accounts of brutality and death that have resulted from Russia's unjust invasion of Ukraine." I can't say it more powerfully than that. And the result of what we're seeing, the Attorney General said, is that the U.S., quote, "stands in solidarity with the people of Ukraine in the face of Russia's continued aggression and assault on Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity," close quote. We who work for the AG are privileged to be able to work on these cases. He has charged us with being relentless in the pursuit of the perpetrators, and I can assure you that that is precisely what we are doing and will do.
Mr. Rosenbaum, during the USIP event last month, you said that the goal of these investigations is that both the perpetrators and facilitators of war crimes are held accountable. Who are the facilitators?
The facilitators of the crimes include, for example, sanctioned individuals and other persons involved in Russian illicit finance and sanctions invasion in support of the Russian regime and its efforts to undermine Ukrainian sovereignty. In March, the Attorney General announced the creation of the Kleptocapture Task Force to further leverage the department's tools and authorities against efforts to evade or undermine economic actions taken by the U.S. government in response to Russia's unprovoked military aggression. The task force has already facilitated the seizure of super yachts of sanctioned individuals with close ties to the Russian regime. There's been a lot of press reporting and photography on that. They've dismantled Russian criminal networks and they've enforced sanctions violations, among other actions. The Justice Department will be providing Ukraine with an expert Justice Department prosecutor to advise on fighting kleptocracy, corruption, money laundering, and the like. In addition, our department plans to deploy two expert attorneys from our Office of International Affairs, one to a U.S. embassy in Europe and another to a U.S. embassy in the Middle East. Those senior attorneys will work closely with their counterparts in EU member states and Middle Eastern countries to promote mutual legal assistance and extraditions, including in support of the department's kleptocapture task force and its work related to Russian illicit finance and sanctions evasion.
Masoud Farivar is VOA's justice correspondent, and he was speaking with the Justice Department's Director of Human Rights Enforcement Strategy and Policy, Eli Rosenbaum, as well as the lead prosecutor for the War Crimes Accountability Team, Christian Levesque. Russia denies committing any war crimes and has opposed any investigations into its actions in Ukraine. Now, we'll pick up the last part of their conversation tomorrow as Masoud discusses the prospects of holding individuals accountable in the absence of an extradition treaty. Former military instructors from both the United States and Britain have volunteered to train members of the Ukrainian Territorial Defense and Special Forces. Anna Kostachenko observed the training process.
Former American and British military instructors are preparing Ukrainian soldiers for unexpected engagements and withdrawals at the Territorial Defense Training Center in the suburbs of Kyiv.
We're trying to just give as many tools as we can to them in order to ensure that they get to come home.
Gray, who says he has experience in U.S. Special Forces, hides his identity. Along with other instructors, he came to this training center to pass on his experience to Ukrainians.
And the rest of my guys have, some of them have decent cover. Yes. I may just pull him out.
The idea is to train as many Ukrainian military personnel as possible, so they in turn can pass it on to their fellow soldiers.
Our defense squads are divided into groups. The foreign instructors are conducting general training, and our local instructors are responsible for conducting training at each location with the help of translators.
The military confrontation with Russia is quick and intense. Receiving training from highly skilled experts is crucial, one instructor says.
The fact that our American friends came to us and are conducting training for the armed forces is very important. Their combat experience is very useful.
Ukrainian soldiers learn to work in forest areas, operate in groups, conduct rescue missions, and clear out buildings.
You can't win a war without infantry. You can have all the howitzers and Bayraktars and you know, weapons, but if you don't have trained soldiers to take back land and occupy and defend that land, you can't win.
Both new recruits and experienced fighters are grateful for this training.
We have learned a lot from this training. We will add this knowledge to our own tactics, and it will be very useful.
Standardized commands and new tactical experience are quickly turning Ukrainian troops into an effective Western-style fighting force. Anna Kostyuchenko for VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.